Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 217, and it's the story of James Meredith and the Oxford Riots. Most people know this story as the very famous and forced entry of the first black man to attend the University of Mississippi, the story of James Meredith. It's an epic event in civil rights history, one of the most important events in the advancement of the civil rights cause. Nowhere in this country was there deep-rooted racism that was more widespread than in Mississippi in those days. Nowhere in this country was it more normal to live in segregation as the cultural norm. For those of you who have stuck with me on this long wander related to the JFK assassination, you may ask why I am covering this material. And some of you will bring up and recall the series of episodes that I presented on Cuba, something that some of you found interesting, and others perhaps not so much. But my connection and fascination with that topic was somewhat homegrown, because I grew up in South Florida, and I personally experienced the earlier years of that migration and immigration and then transformation. There was a special connection for me then to the Cuban element. And maybe that resulted in a bigger wander on my part than was necessary when it came to the origins of the Cuban matter. Just about anyone can argue that you don't need to study Columbus and his debut on the island of Cuba to understand the Kennedy assassination. I get that. But what I am trying to preserve here in the overall context of this podcast is that the events that occurred in 1963 and in that era generally were all a product of their time, all a product of their cumulative history up to that point, all a product of the social norms that then persisted, and finally, the true visceral reality of that time. Nothing more, nothing less. It's hard for most of us to imagine that world, even though, measured in years, it was only about 60 years ago. Not a long time. And yet it's a world away from where we are now, in just so many ways that are often too hard to even count. Which brings me to why we are going to discuss the Oxford Riot today. And note that I say the topic is not James Meredith today, so much as it is the riots themselves. And yes, I mean riots. If you Google James Meredith, you get mostly the story about his entrance as the first black man to enter the University of Mississippi. You see him flanked by two federal government officials as he is ushered into the school. But what you see little of is the incredible violence that engulfed the event. Most people know there was a tension, but the event is not necessarily known for the violence of it. Most people don't know that James Meredith's entrance to the University of Mississippi, well, up to that point in time, it was the largest invocation of the Insurrection Act of 1806 that had ever occurred in this country. Why this particular event is so important in our story? Well, it's because it was more than the admission of a black man to an all-white university. It was an event that was met with an escalation of violence that was not seen on this scale heretofore. The civil rights movement was gaining momentum, and the forces against it were equal and opposite. Opposing forces that were willing to apply violence to what was ostensibly, at that moment, still, for the most part, a nonviolent civil rights movement. Something was different about the riots at Oxford. It wasn't just a handful of white supremacists that had been energized, although that element was certainly present and certainly part of the circumstance at Oxford. But there was the uglier side of a broader societal backlash around what was happening. And what was happening was the tearing down of a way of life, segregation, peacefully accepted by many, actually, both black and white at the time, accepted for the last 100 years or so. And to some, at least in their own minds, accepted without malice. It was accepted as a God-given rule, not aimed at any one person, but universally accepted as both the law and gospel. Others were even more hardline in their thoughts. They saw these epic events, in this particular case being the integration of the university, as the beginning of a free fall in society. Segregation was the Rubicon, a line one does not cross in society, because once crossed, there is no turning back. And a mixing of the races was seen as the beginning of the end. Society in Mississippi sensed that. And the widespread participation in those riots at Oxford was validation of how widespread and deeply entrenched these concepts were. The very nature of this riot ensured that the more radical right-wing extremists in the South would become more emboldened to accelerate their own violent actions. It was a war of sorts, sure enough, and like Antietam or Gettysburg or Manassas or Vicksburg some 100 years before, some sort of violence was going to be a part of it. The Kennedy administration met this circumstance head-on. Officially, almost 31,000 enforcement officers, National Guardsmen, and members of the United States Armed Forces would be engaged in the Oxford riot and its aftermath, along with the events which preceded it. Not all of these men actively participated, but that official number in and of itself is massive. Little more is needed to understand the epic meaning of this domestic disturbance in America. But as usual, we will dive deeper. As we move through this mini-series, the violence at Oxford gave us a better understanding of how the radical right could have operated the way that they did in these environments in that era, back in 62 and 63 and in years prior and afterward. And in fact, it sets us up for the pivot back into the story of those forces that ultimately may have been involved in the assassination of President Kennedy. The story of these embedded networks that feature men such as J.B. Stoner, Sam Bowers, or men like Wesley Swift and the influence of the Church of Jesus Christ Christian. And then the hate that would develop in those radical right instigators for people like John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. The hate that follows those who stand in the way of segregation. On the campus at Ole Miss stands a statue of James Meredith. It's a part of the Civil Rights Memorial. The statue is positioned so that he is seen heading toward another part of the memorial, a portal. The symbolism is clear, reflecting his great passage, along with the passage of the civil rights struggle itself, as they both enter a new era. Statues and memorials are tasked with capturing so much. The essence is there, of course, but what is absent are the details that encompass the great struggle of that moment. It was, honestly, a kind of war. And today and throughout this mini-wander of episodes, we tell the story of the war that happened in those moments around Oxford. We tell it from the warrior's standpoint. We tell the story of the enormous force that was required by our government to move the world forward in that moment. It should be no surprise after this wander about the seriousness of those involved in the opposition. The deadly measures that citizens were willing to engage in against the government as they mounted a futile resistance to this change. It should be no surprise, then, that many of them were perfectly willing to kill the president and the leaders of the civil rights movement. Now, these stories are all going to tie together. But first, and today, it's a look at the violence in Oxford and the Kennedy administration's show of force there. Most of what you'll hear today is part of an official history of that event that was developed by our own government afterward. I'll read much of it word for word. So, without further ado, let's listen to the rest of episode 217 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. In the spring of 1961, Mississippi was one of the last three states. South Carolina and Alabama were the others, still maintaining a complete racial segregation in public institutions. South Carolina, however, would soon yield quietly at the state-supported college level. Even when compared with neighboring Alabama, Mississippi was intransigent. The state lagged in industrial progress and was the poorer of the two. It also had the third highest illiteracy rate in the nation. The Citizens Council dominated its politics, much of its business community, and the lives of its people. Under Governor Ross R. Barnett, the Citizens Council acquired semi-official status because an official state commission subsidized its propaganda. Of Mississippi citizens over 20 years of age who were registered voters, 95% were white and only 2% were black. As Professor James W. Silver put it, the state was, for all intents, a closed society. In this setting, in January 1961, James Howard Meredith, a young Mississippi-born former Air Force Staff Sergeant and student at the all-black Jackson State College, applied for admission to the University of Mississippi at Oxford. The school formally rejected his application on the 25th of May, provoking litigation that resulted 1 month later in a decision by a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit Court that Meredith had been denied access on racial grounds. As a result, on September 13, 1962, U.S. District Court Judge Sidney C. Mize issued a sweeping injunction that guaranteed Meredith's enrollment at the university without discrimination. In Washington, both the Department of Justice and the Department of the Army realized that they might have to intervene in Mississippi. The Army's role, once again, would be that of an executive agent for the Department of Defense, and it would find basic guidance in the Army Strategic Capabilities Plan. As early as the 8th of September, 1962, Army leaders knew that they might have to provide a tent camp and other logistical support for federal marshals in the Oxford area and possibly active military support as well. Involvement became almost certain on September 13th when Judge Mize issued his injunction and Governor Barnett, in a public address, invoked the doctrine of interposition, the theory that a state, by placing its sovereignty between the federal government and its own citizens, could render a federal act null and void, or even brand it unconstitutional. Barnett pledged that he and other Mississippi officials would go to jail rather than submit to the federal court. Planning began in earnest with an interdepartmental meeting that apparently took place in anticipation of Barnett's edict of interposition, or shortly after he issued it. Representing the Army were Secretary Cyrus R. Vance, Under Secretary Stephen Ailes, the Director of Operations, the Office of the Deputy Chief of Staff for Military Operations, Major General Creighton W. Abrams, Jr., and an aide to Vance, and Colonel James L. Baldwin. The Assistant Vice Chief of Staff of the Air Force, Major General John K. Hester, represented that service. Assistant Attorney General Burke Marshall, and another Assistant Deputy Attorney General, William A. Gauguin, represented the Department of Justice. Marshall described the problem as the Department of Justice saw it. The university was under court order to admit Meredith, who would attempt to register on September 20th, the day before classes were to begin. There would probably be public disorder. The Mississippi State Police would interfere with Meredith's enrollment, and Barnett's orders to all state officials to resist the enrollment would be carried out. Gauguin then outlined the department's plans. Justice would use, if necessary, 190 federal deputy marshals with a reserve force of about 100, based at Memphis Naval Air Station in Tennessee. The Marshals would have their own radios and vehicles together with chartered commercial helicopters. If the operation were prolonged, however, they would need a base closer to Oxford in Holly Springs National Forest, where the Army would be asked to establish a tent camp for 300 men. Marshall observed that efforts at civil enforcement of the court orders might not succeed and that armed forces might also be required. In reply, Vance stressed the far-reaching implications of a resort to force and urged that all other solutions be fully explored first. Nonetheless, he agreed to provide the tent camp, should it become necessary, and he authorized the Army to plan for the possible use of troops. Vance and Marshall agreed that the two departments would communicate through Abrams and Gauguin. Hester promised Air Force assistance as necessary. Responsibility for drawing up detailed plans rested with the staff of the Office of the Deputy Chief of Staff for Military Operations. Abrams was to become the personal representative of the Chief of Staff for Oxford Matters, serving first General George H. Decker and then General Earl G. Wheeler, who was to be named Chief of Staff on October 1, 1962. Although Abrams would have day-to-day operational responsibility, the principal burden of coordinating the operations plan would fall upon an action officer. His name was Lieutenant Colonel Gordon C. Jung. As one of his first tasks, Jung sought out the checklist that had been prepared after the Little Rock affair. This original black book, so to speak, on the Arkansas operation, amplified by a file of memorandums tracing the Army's role during the trouble over the Freedom Rides the year before, provided a starting point for planning. Since separate preparations were needed for the tent city and for the tactical forces, staff agencies and technical services had to draw up plans for both. Memphis Naval Air Station became a staging area for both the troops and the marshals. The facility seemed particularly well-suited for the operation because it was only 70 miles by air from Oxford, and it stood outside the boundaries of Mississippi. The Office of the Chief of Information was one of the first Army agencies Abrams alerted. Under the public affairs guidance that evolved, if the Army provided only the tent city, it would have no function except to ensure logistical support for the marshals and would refer all queries to the senior Department of Justice official at the scene. But should actual military intervention become necessary, a field information section would clear all proposed military statements with the Department of Justice, which, in contrast to Little Rock, where the Army alone had made such decisions, they would be responsible for the actual release of information. The troops would receive a general orientation and daily updates to ensure that they understood their role as upholders of the rule of law. As the Army's information officials saw it, restraint and firmness would be key criteria for the success of the operation. Abrams brought the Office of the Judge Advocate General into the planning on September 14th because of a need for legal advice and services. He also alerted the Chief Signal Officer, Major General Earl F. Cook, to the need for direct communications between his own office, the Department of Justice, the Army War Room in the Pentagon, the Federal Marshals at the Naval Air Station, and the Marshals in Oxford. Cook presented a plan the next day that could be implemented in 24 hours. A conflict soon developed between the requirements for secrecy and the need to inform subordinates of what was happening to ensure proper planning. The political sensitivities involved in armed intervention required all concerned to proceed with great discretion. Because of that, those who knew the full dimensions of what was happening were forbidden to discuss it openly. And with limited exceptions, military personnel engaged in planning were instructed to stay clear of Mississippi. As a result, some officers in crucial positions learned of the operation late, leading some staff agencies to complain that they had insufficient time to make necessary preparations. When General Abrams finally brought the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence into the planning on September 26th, for example, he urged that the Army's interest in the crisis be concealed, even though he understood that such concealment would hamper the collection of information. The Chief of the National Guard Bureau, the Provost Marshal General, and the Deputy Chief of Staff for Personnel learned about the matter even later, somewhere between September 27th and September 29th. The Continental Army Command began work on plans for the tent city on September 15th. As with the Washington agencies, there was heavy emphasis upon the sensitive nature of the enterprise, leading planners to assume that official taskings would have to be assigned on short notice. To keep the possibility of military involvement from the public eye, General Abrams and the CONARC commander, General Herbert B. Powell, apparently agreed that a training exercise called High Heels 2 / Spade Fork, which was then in progress, should provide cover for preparations. The scenario for the exercise would be rewritten to include critical problems supposedly arising as a result of a natural disaster and subsequent civil disorder. Under this pretense, the Army would be able to alert forces in the 3rd and 4th Army areas for both the tent city and the task forces without anyone becoming the wiser. It would also be able to requisition transportation, tentage, mess equipment, cots, bedding, showers, latrines, electric lighting, and signal communications equipment without drawing attention to its true objective. As planning advanced, decisions were made on a broad range of issues. The Army staff agreed to give CONARC a 48-hour alert for establishing the tent city. The commander of that effort would be responsible through the normal chain of command to the commanding general, 3rd U.S. Army, and CONARC. The tactical task force commander would remain separate, having no responsibility for the tent city. The Department of the Army would maintain communications between itself, the Justice Department, the field commander, the Marshal's office in Oxford, and the tent city, while CONARC would provide administrative support for signal personnel in the tent city itself. Finally, the participants agreed that although Army regulations required clearance with state police for the movement of military convoys, this policy would be waived in the event of a deployment to Mississippi. As for keeping the units involved integrated or stripping them of their Negro personnel, they were to maintain their racial composition, subject to final confirmation by Washington. By September 19th, the day before Meredith was scheduled to appear at the university for registration, the 70th Engineer Battalion, a unit garrisoned at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, had been selected to build and operate the tent city. Instructions went out to the 3rd Army, emphasizing that this would be an actual operational mission, rather than the sort of simulated movement of forces and/or equipment planned as part of High Heels. The engineers would take small arms and gas masks, but no crew-served weapons. Meanwhile, Army Public Affairs policy continued to conceal the nature of the projected operation at Oxford. To keep public speculation to a minimum, queries on the engineers' operations were to be answered with the explanation that the engineers were on a routine Defense Department test of plans for emergency civil defense operations. The troops were to be told much the same thing, that the testing of operational plans would require movement to a place near Memphis to set up a model refugee camp for tornado victims. The order to execute might be expected at any time subsequent to 1 o'clock in the morning, Eastern Daylight Time, on September 20th. And those involved should be prepared for operations of indefinite length under field conditions. The emphasis on secrecy in advance of the move was, perhaps understandable, but a failure to provide for frank public information on the subject, if the move had to be made, was not. While the Army prepared, a complicated political drama played out between the president and his advisors in Washington and the administration of Governor Barnett in Jackson, Mississippi. While Department of Justice officials attempted unsuccessfully to enroll Meredith at least four times, the telephone wires between Washington and Jackson burned with a series of frustrating conversations between Robert Kennedy, Burke Marshall, and even the president on one side, and Barnett, the Mississippi Attorney General, and at least two intermediaries on the other. Thank you for listening to episode 217 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. And join us in episode 218 for a continuation of the story of James Meredith and the Oxford Riots.